copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
So grateful to be with you, and so honored I feel that to speak about best practices in theological education for colleagues and theologians is quite a challenge, because I'm not sure that what I would present is really the best practices, but this is the my experience through the years I served in as a president of the seminary since 2000 to this moment. I want to say that a short story for my experience. I returned back from Aberdeen in after discussing my viva in or having my viva, discussing my thesis at December 1999. So end of 99. And the seminary was in where I serve is quite an old one, established in 1863, 154 years old now. The seminary was in worst case at that time, conflict between the board and administration that led that everything became wrong. So student body collapsed, most of good professors, Egyptians, and foreigners left the seminary. The seminary financially was almost on bankruptcy. All the facilities were damaged. So I went back, and the whole spirit was really tough. The relationship with the church was disconnected because of this long conflict between the board and the administration. So a few months after that, they removed the president, and I was 42 years old, coming back with dreams to teach more, write, and as a previous youth minister or so, I wanted to spend time with my students. Nothing of that happened. Just 3 or 4 months as the board was meeting on March 2000, they selected me to be the president of the seminary. And some of you probably heard this story, but in brief, I was very nervous, not knowing that, resisted with and argued with the board that I don't have the experience. This is not on my radar. I don't want it, but they needed a scapegoat or someone to carry the responsibility. So at the end, I had to accept. But all what I managed to do is to ask for 4 months from March to early July to just prepare my vision, my thoughts for such challenge. And I went to the intensive care because I was very nervous of not feeling able to carry the responsibility. What what the Lord had in mind is something very different, where I was almost rebuked through reading the Bible that it's not me who would be responsible to do that, and the image of Elijah, who thought that he is alone. They killed all the faithful ones, the prophets, and I am alone. And the Lord said that there were 7,000 persons who never knelt to Baal are there. So I discovered that why I am nervous, as if I am alone, responsible to fix the problems and challenges in my context. And I thought that I need to change my understanding of leadership and my approach to think in humility. Who are faithful people around me that probably need to be encouraged, empowered, helped to do their work, instead of thinking that I will be the person responsible to do the work and fix every problem there. And this was my story with the seminary. So all what I will share with you guys was a challenge where the seminary moved from being so much struggling to great success in many areas. We were 69 students, almost 90% of them with high school graduates, to now 320 students, all are university graduates, we don't admit. So we raised the bar high. And I was the only one at that time returning with a PhD. Now we have 11 people with PhDs from different parts and four in the pipeline, and great success in many things. I am not sharing in anything in pride, because most of the areas of success happened in areas of my weakness that I'm not, I never felt strong in, including fundraising, including changes in the in many of these things. So I gave the praise of God for that. But part of what we learned is that we had about 23 sessions of hearing and listening to the older graduates and recent graduates and ordinary people who do not know us except from our product, from the pastors or the graduates they see. And we asked all kind of questions you can imagine. What were the things when you were a student that benefited you as you graduated? What were the things that you wish that were different? What were the things that you felt that was good, were good to continue doing? What were the things that you think need to change? What are the courses or things that were not practical? And for the people who do not know us except from the our graduates, how do you see our graduates? What are the strong points? What are the weak points you see? And to summarize some of the things before I show my presentation, students said that we felt that there was progress in spirituality in the seminary. This was great. The relationship with the professors were very friendly. This was great. But in many areas, we were not skillful enough. Lots of things were very much theoretical. And when it comes to spirituality, you made great progress in this area, but we always took our spirituality from outside the class, in chapel or in fellowship days and so on. We hardly felt that the classroom would provide us with spirituality. For the common people, they say that your graduates are very good in preaching and teaching, but we feel that they are more like philosophers. So they have very good mind. They can speak in a good way and communicate in a good way, but we felt that they really lack the skills of leadership. So those who didn't go to the seminary are better than them in leading discussion, leading small group, doing administration and management. So they are weak in skills. And also, not all of them, we feel that with some of them at least, there is separation between what they say and what they live. These were some of the major concerns we heard as we were after finishing the very big problems and then focusing on the curriculum we taught. So some or most of what I would share with you will be a result of these things. So best practices in theological education, I will give the model I know. This is the wonderful country, Egypt, that I wish you all come and visit one day. And this is our seminary. This building, the seminary started in 1863, but was for a while in the south. And when moved to Cairo, this building was the first building in 1926. And we added other buildings, of course, on campus. What's best practice? The simple definition of best practice is a method or technique that has consistently shown results superior to those achieved with other means, which lead to using it, to use this method, to use it as a benchmark. This can be a simple definition of a best practice. I have myself challenged with best practice when it comes to the realm of theological education, and I will mention some of these challenges. There is a difficult task when we come to apply this definition on theological education. The term is a business term that brought up in business term, especially manufacturers, rather than being theological. Practices cannot amount to being named best practices unless and until they are tried long enough and have proven success over other traditional means. And most of these things are relatively not old enough or practiced long enough. It's my experience through 15 or 17 years. This is one of my problems, I need to admit. Best practice as a business term used to describe the process of developing and following standards, specific standards of doing things that multiple similar organizations can use. And this sounds more mechanical than human. So if we say that this is the way to manufacture this part or this car or this issue, you need to stick to that. But when it comes to humanity or humanities and theology, it's difficult to apply it. In realm of education and transformation, things cannot be repeated or copied verbatim. Every case and context has its own distinctiveness. So I feel that we cannot take the term best practices and borrow it from the manufacturing and business realm and apply it verbatim on theological education. The idea of best practices might choke or kill creativity needed to consider the special needs and distinctiveness of each context. Each context has its own distinctiveness and strength. And if you talk that you have to do things this way, otherwise you are not doing or best practices, then you will kill the possibility of being creative or using your sharp edge. However, there are some advantages of best practice at least with understanding or knowledge of the disadvantages to avoid them. So the first advantage, in my opinion, that best practices should help maintaining quality standards based on self-assessment and shareholder satisfaction, which lead theological institutes to move from just assessing their performance towards caring for and assessing their output and impact. We need to learn something from the business world to some extent, in my view. In best scenario, boards of seminaries would assess the performance of the administration. How do you do with your admission, your numbers, your degrees, your finances, how you handle them? So they assess our performance, and we feel satisfied, and they probably, boards would feel satisfied if they see us doing good job on objective and reasonable criteria. But this is not enough. Why we are doing what we are doing is not really measured. From business world, we can know, and from the term best practice, we can start to assess outcome, and not just outcome like the graduates in terms of number and in terms of quality, but the impact of our graduates, the impact our graduates are doing as they graduate. Are they really fulfilling the mission for which we exist as a seminary? Do they really change the life of people where they serve and church and preach? Are they really making difference in the life of society where they serve? These are the things that would be more about not assessing and evaluating performance, but assessing output and impact. And the idea of best practice that we can borrow from the business world is really important in moving us as seminaries towards this level. And as we exercise, as seminaries exercise best practices, or as theological institutes exercise best practices, if they keep the balance between the distinctive qualities of their institute, of their context, and the common qualities shared by other similar institutes, I think they can do something great. So on the one hand, I say that this advantage is that if we copy each other in committing to certain best practices, we may choke creativity and lose our distinctive edge. But what I'm saying here that we still can share common ground with similar institutes in doing things in the right way, for the right purpose and for the right mission. At the same time, we can still be aware of our distinctiveness and give it room as we do best practices. From my limited and humble experience, I felt that in theological education, we need to do some ideological shifts in many areas that we used to do and to think that this is the only way of doing theological education. And I will mention some of the ideological shifts that I think need to be considered. First, moving from the humanity focus to theo focus. Surprisingly, we are theological institutes, but we were, during many years, we were even, our departments of theology are under humanities. And we swallowed that in some sense. And many institutes think that the focus is we study theology for the sake of serving humanity better, which is not bad. But I think we cannot serve humanity in a good way, or humans in a good way, without having theological focus. Here are some questions that we really need to ask ourselves. Does theological education help students to get a better understanding of God? It's an important question. I never forget comments of common people who would say, we don't know what happens in your seminaries. People come vibrant, faithful, enthusiastic about knowing God more, and they get out lukewarm and have doubts about their relationship with God. How come while we are theological institutes, would our what we teach them or educate them help them to get better understanding of God? Does it give them better experience of God, not just their better understanding? Would they go out with better and stronger and intimate relationship with God? Does the classroom help spiritual formation? This is what I commented at the beginning, that even those who felt that the seminary helped them their lives, surprisingly, they felt that this happened in secondary activities in chapel, or not in classroom. Do we study humanities for their own sake? Of course, there is a relationship. You cannot have solid theological education without having something about philosophy, sociology, psychology. I'm not against that at all. They must understand that. But do we study humanities for their own sake or for better understanding of God? Another shift that I think is needed. Shifting from the focus from teaching to learning. From teaching to learning. Education is more about learner formation than knowledge transmission. If we think that it's theological institutes are places to teach people, that's very fine. But the focus is how good the teacher is, what degrees the teacher holds, how eloquent the teacher could be, but how much of that is really shaping and changing or helping students to learn something. Nowadays, there is quite a shift, and it's important shift, about the focus. The focus is about, at the end of the day, we need students to learn something. Accordingly, student should be the focus of both teacher and curriculum, not vice versa. Here are examples of we used to be satisfied if we have solid curriculum that has great bibliography and readings at the end and very well designed, the grades are clear, fine. But how about what we call hidden curriculum or indirect curriculum that probably affects the students more than we can imagine? I can teach a course about stewardship, and have the best reading books and material and best lectures there. But there is a hidden curriculum that they can get from my life as professor and from what I present to them. If they see me missing out with time or missing out with resources, even things like clinics or whatever we have, or tissue or so, and, I give wrong message, or I give certain message about stewardship that I cannot fix with the best readings or teaching I'm giving. If I speak to them about humility, but they see in my relationship with professors, with colleagues, spirit of competition and spirit of not respecting them and a spirit of arrogance, I think the best thing I teach will not do the work. So, if we are serious about that, curriculum, professors or teachers should all serve the student as a learner, because learning is the important focus for us. Moving from pedagogy to andragogy, and you know, actually the literal translation of pedagogy is education for children, but we use it unfortunately for any kind of education. We say the pedagogy, we speak about education, but andragogy is the education for adults, where adult education should require students to learn from each other. Sometimes we treat students as if they are kids, but if we recognize that they are adults, so there is something different. They don't just learn from us and from the curriculum, but they learn from each other. Do we give enough time for them to come to share their great experience? Some of our students are more skillful than we are. They have probably not the knowledge we have through our PhDs and so on, but they have great experience in mission, in preaching, in evangelism, in social work, and so on. Where is the chance for them to learn from each other? Adult education assumes personal learning responsibility. Again, don't allow your students to deceive you or enforce you to spoil them, as if you are responsible to follow up their readings and to follow up these things and to give them summary for everything. They need to grow up as adults responsible for their actions, their studies, their learning process. Adult education aims for lifelong learning. Again, would you really make sure by the end of the course you are teaching that you didn't give just important education, but you give methods and you give keys that would help them to keep doing the good work? One of the things I thank God for getting my training or my PhD in the UK, though for years I always felt inferior to those who studied in other parts of the world, because we don't have in the PhD classrooms, so it's all research, but it helped me to some way or another to be responsible for educating myself. It's not that simple. You sit with your supervisor, you sit in events, and they assess you and give you important keys, but you feel responsible. It really was, in some way or another, a model of adult education. moving from another shift, moving from more for mere orthodoxy to orthopraxy. Orthodoxy is the sound teaching, sound knowledge. And it's definitely important for us as theologians, especially those who are connected to denominations or churches. But orthopraxy is something about the sound, not just sound doctrine, but sound life. From being content with sound doctrine to seeking sound conduct. It's important that you graduate. The comment that they say to me that you graduate philosophers was not something to commend. Yes, I have people who have sound and great ideas, but we need people who have sound life. From mental reshaping to life shaped on the cognitive, affective, and behavior dimensions. Shaping life, we are not against, or we cannot be dispense with or take lightly the importance of shaping the mind and thoughts, but you have responsibility towards attitudes, the heart, and also skills and practical life. So we always remind with ourselves with 3H, head, heart, and hand. I think these are very important things to be shaped and reshaped through our education. Another shift is from generalization to distinctiveness of the institution. So generalization is important. You to be a solid, respected institute, you need to follow some common ground for accreditation or for whatever of doing things the right way, but don't ever neglect your distinctive context and distinctive situation. Even if it is a situation of crisis, it can give you a chance much better than others. What's distinctive about your institution? When I thought of mine, I thought that we are in, of course, we have some nice distinctive things like the old Egyptian history, the Coptic history, and so on. But one of the things that we never ever thought of as a distinctive situation is being in Islamic country and living in Islamic country for years. When we thought of that, you could see it a threat, and it is a threat in many ways, but it offers distinctive situation because we, for years, Christians in the Middle East and especially in Egypt, we're probably the earliest to handle apologetics. We have wonderful writings from the 9th and 10th century. Ken Bailey said that they are probably 9 million pages in Arabic, written in Arabic, most of which is in areas of apologetics, where Arabic Christian theologians try to make Christianity or Christian theology meaningful and understood by the Muslim neighbor. Instead of attacking us every time, you worship 3 gods, we started to explain what Trinity means and what is about. When they attack you about of being blasphemers because we consider Jesus as divine, we had to answer this and to say, why do we do that? And while we do that, are we really committing blasphemy or not? And about the corruption of the Bible, these are the questions that arise in Islamic areas, and we we need to have answers for them instead of just being passive or negative and crying all the time that we have problems. And this gives us, I cannot live in Egypt without having very strong courses about Islam, understanding Islam, how to answer the questions of Islam. And I think my seminary became one of the strongest in this area. We have great library in this area. It turned to be a blessing for us. Could your context be your cutting edge? It's an important question. Please take this seriously and ask yourself, when I say your context or your circumstances, what you see as great blessing and what you see a threat, those who are coming from communist background, those who live in an area where atheism is, or materialism is very major. Could this challenge you in a way to be a blessing to the whole world? How to handle such tough issues? Shifting from mass education to the personal focus on each student. It's difficult, but at least for, you may have many programs, but for those who are probably in the area of Master of Divinity, those who will be pastors or so, and will give all the life and time for ministry in particular, you need, in addition to having programs that would serve them all, to have certain care and concern for the distinctiveness of each student. What's distinctive about each of your students? Do you have something distinctive in special skills or in special experience or in their call in a way that you see that something not regular, not coming every day, you have a person with a call that's really new, fresh, can make difference in the world? Or you have someone who is distinctive in personality? What areas of focus may develop their areas of strength, these areas of strength? Shifting from monologue to student teaching teacher or student teacher Q&A into dialogue, where I consider this communal, that the best development or enhancement we do sometimes is, instead of preaching or teaching the whole lecture, I give 10 minutes for Q&A. This is not enough. I'm saying that you need really every now and then to open for dialogue and allow chance for the real dynamics and learning from each other, shifting from abstract to concrete, from scholastic, philosophical, theological models to practical and market theology models. Can our theology be market theology? I don't think it's a bad term, but I mean by this that theology that can have make sense in the market, in the real life. From mere church-based experience into word-based experience. Here are some examples of that we discovered. We used to send our students every summer, the MDiv students, the Master of Divinity, the ones who will be ordained, to churches. And the maximum change we'll do, that 1 year we send them to urban context and the other year to rural context or rural church. But at the end of the day, the kind of problems and challenges that they face in a church is something about maybe the how attractive the preaching is, what kind of conflict between the leaders, who is possessive of the authority among the elders, you know, the quality of problems they see. We started to send our students at least once a year during their study to very, very, very practical fields, like orphanages, like homeless ministry. We have quite a number of street children who no one knows. They try to arrest them because of the problems they are causing in the street, and an eight-year-old child may be having sex or drugs and so on. They sleep under bridges and so on. In prison ministry, to prison ministry, to hospitals and clinics, to elderly homes, to serve among those who suffer from mental or physical disability, for among those who suffer from addiction, and in very poor slums, not even licensed or formal churches, and to some parts of the difficult world like Sudan in mission. Actually, our students came back with very different attitude, very different questions. Many of them would tell us that we felt that we were living in incubators. Even those who come from poor families, but at the end of the day, Christian, kind families. But for some of them to say that we were serving among the slums, where a family of 10 people, the father, the mother, the sons, the children, the uncle, and the grandparents probably live in one room without a toilet. So, and they probably sharing things with another room, where the uncle or the father may have sex with the daughter or so. And for a young kid to see this, it's tough. But this is the real society. This is what's happening this is not the ivory tower they live in. They came much serious. They cry sometimes, and we cry with them. But we started to think how to handle such problems. They became much serious in studies, in their call, in their questions. In the rest of the years, they stay with us. Here, of course, some of the examples about the context and distinctiveness of the context that we hear is examples of Coptic tradition and monasticism, and translations and manuscripts like Sinaiticus, the Alexandrius, and the Arabic translations. There are great heritage. We started a center for Middle Eastern Christianity that would revive this history and tradition. So your context, even with your challenges, can be your sharp edge. Let me finish with some final remarks. It made difference in our life when our mission statement was revised and was the center of each program and activity we do. Mission statement, we never thought that it's important. But if you are serious, it either needs to be changed. If it's not clear, mission statement is the reason for which you exist. And it needs to be revised every now and then, but it needs to be applied every day and be your people. Your staff, administrative and faculty, and students need to be reminded with it. If it's worth your existence, then it needs your attention. So, we started to ask ourselves, how does this program, this course, this activity contribute to the mission of the Institute? And now in each curriculum, at the very beginning, the mission statement is mentioned in 2-3 lines. And then the first question is how this course would contribute to the mission of your institute. I teach now for over 27 years, and I tell you the truth, this is a very difficult question to answer. Sometimes when I think of elementary Greek, and I think how this would help equip people to serve the church and change society, it's not easy to think how I apply this, but it helped me to get rid of lots of things that I was teaching and I felt that not helpful to this course, and to add and create things that I never thought of to make this course valuable. And in fact, we had to merge some courses because we felt that they do not help as they stand in the same way, and we have to cancel some courses altogether because of this fact. We have to cancel some programs and activities for training and so on and replace them with others because we discovered that we are doing them or mechanically, but they do not really contribute to our mission, the reason for our existence. Create core values that reflect your identity as Christian and probably evangelical, the way, whatever identity you claim for yourself, and check them frequently to make sure they are maintained in all community life aspects. Do you have core values? If not, please create them. And if you have, please revise them, because they probably something need to be created or embedded or taking off due to the many changes happening in the world. And if you have them, make them or make sure that they are applied and taken care of. To track students' development, keep note of the admission committee's remarks and develop mechanism for annual assessment. Some seminaries, and I really commend that, take seriously the admission and be asked about the call, the reason for students coming, and either through very detailed applications or interviews or many things. And this is great to make sure that the admittees or the admitted students are worth coming to your institute. That's great, but you have to know they are here, and you have to see, is their progress in their goal, in their vision, in their skills, in their attitudes, the remarks you had, you need to measure, are they really developing in them, or staying straight in them, or really losing some of the good things that they came with. So have a way of measuring that every year, and at the end of the year you will even give them a chance to see report or so that you came here, these are where your own words, and we see you now there, where do you see yourself? Critical thinking is important. Critical and analytical thinking are very important in my view, but not just for their own sake. Critical thinking should lead graduates to develop the ability to assess life issues in view of biblical teaching and kingdom values. To create critical thinking is just to doubt or to write, to ask good questions about who wrote this, when this was wrote, or and so on, fine. But actually, what's more important is that you help people as they see, not necessarily biblical things, secular things. They can, in view of and in the glasses of the theology they learned and biblical teaching they learned, they can say, this is a good thing. Here's a problem that we need to handle. Here's a challenge that we need to educate our kids and young people to develop, and so on. So please make sure that critical thinking would help your graduates to read and see the world in a different eyes and glasses. Create a capstone for your programs that helps graduates to rediscern vision, mission, and goal. Probably a final course, one course at the last year or so, that try to bring together all what they learned and help them to see the endeavor of the tough work that you had. Please stop here.